Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Coming up on the program today, greetings, my friends. Slaves! How many does Justice Scalia want to own? Also, the photos America doesn't want seen or out. They're tragic. Do Americans trust the UN more than Bush on Iran? And is Cheney silent about his hunting incident because it may involve an illicit romance? Say what? It's getting stranger and stranger, my friends. It's just getting stranger and stranger. But first, Justice Scalia. People who believe the Constitution, this is from the Associated Press, people who believe the Constitution would break if it didn't change with society are idiots, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia says. Now, let me just take you down memory lane just a little bit. Back during the 2004 debates between George W. Bush and John Kerry, George Bush was asked the question, what kind of person would you nominate for the Supreme Court if you were made president in 2004, if you were elected president? And he kind of mumbled around, and then he said, well, for sure, I wouldn't nominate somebody who would vote in favor of Dred Scott. Now, the Dred Scott case is the 1864 case, as I recall. Maybe it was 1865. Anyhow, back then, just before the Civil War, the case from the 1860s that affirmed slavery. Dred Scott was a slave who was arguing that he should be free, you know, and it affirmed slavery. It said, you know, no, slavery is in the Constitution. And in fact, slavery was in the Constitution. In order to get slavery out of the Constitution, we had to amend the Constitution. We had to pass the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But so the question was asked, you know, why was Bush talking about Dred Scott? Why is he talking about a 150-year-old case when asked about the Supreme Court today? I mean, slavery is long gone, or at least that kind of slavery. And it turns out that, and I wrote about this, it's over on BuzzFlash. You can find the article. You go to TomHartman.com and click Articles on Democracy. And it's a piece that I wrote called Bush and Scalia, You Want Privacy Rights, Pass a Law. And it turns out that what Bush was doing was speaking in anti-abortion speak. The anti-abortion movement has, for about a decade, taken the position that fetuses are humans and should have the rights of humans. And not just fetuses, embryos, fetuses, you know, the whole bit, are humans and should have the rights of humans. And therefore, any kind of an abortion is denied, the right to abortion is to deny an entire class of citizens the right to life. And which is what the Dred Scott case did. It denied African Americans the right to life, or at least the right to freedom. And so the anti-abortion movement for a decade now has been saying that Roe v. Wade was the same thing as Dred Scott, that it disenfranchised an entire group of Americans, in this case what they would refer to as unborn Americans, what physicians would refer to as embryos, fetuses, zygotes, whatever. And so that was Bush saying, I'm not going to put somebody on the court who's going to vote against abortion or who's going to vote against Roe v. Wade. I'm going to put somebody on the court who is going to or who's going to uphold Roe v. Wade. I'm going to put somebody on the court who's going to strike down Roe v. Wade. He was saying that just explicitly. And what was amazing to me is that nobody in the press figured this out. I mean, it took several days for there to be, I was discussing it on this radio program, and people in the press hadn't figured it out. And by the time people did figure it out, it was like, you know, 3-4 days had gone by. I wrote the article like 2 days after this, just, you know, to get it out there. But anyhow, this is the same thing. This is back to Scalia. Scalia talking about himself in the third person, and you got to always wonder and worry about people who talk about themselves in the third person. They have a royalty complex that is seriously dangerous stuff. In any case, Scalia said, in his speech Monday night to the Federalist Society that we should stick to the plain text of the Constitution as it was originally written and intended. Now, presumably that, as it was originally written and intended, includes slavery, includes women don't vote, includes indentured servitude. We could come up with quite a list here if you want. Scalia says, and I quote, this is Scalia speaking of himself, Scalia does have a philosophy, it's called originalism. That's what prevents him from doing the things he would like to do. Say what? Well, he says that's what prevents him from apparently ruling on things in ways that would reflect his own opinions. But the fact of the matter is, you know, that Scalia is probably one of the most activist judges on the court. If you define an activist judge as somebody who overturns laws, that is somebody who is aggressively changing legislation. I mean, there is no better, really, I don't think there's any different definition of activism. Scalia is one of the three most activist judges on the court, along with Thomas and was Rehnquist. So anyhow, he says, you've got to be an idiot to believe that the Constitution is a living thing. This whole concept of a living Constitution. And in that, he's taking a swipe at Stephen Breyer. I am reading Stephen Breyer's book right now. I forget the title of it. I got it next to my bed. One of the other justices on the Supreme Court. And he's got this book about the living Constitution. And Scalia, you know, he's calling him an idiot. It's amazing. And you go back to this, and here, this, as Scalia said to the Associated Press, back in 2003. He said, abortion, gay rights, and the right to die are best left to the legislative and executive branches. You want a right to abortion? Pass a law. Now, there's two problems with this statement. The first is, he says, if you want a right, if you want one of these rights, pass a law. The state of Oregon actually did pass a law. It's called the Death with Dignity Act that allows people to commit suicide if they're within 6 months of dying, if they have a terminal illness, if they are of sound mind, and if two doctors have certified that they are in intractable pain and that there is no possibility that they will recover, that they can prescribe them life-ending medication, an overdose of barbiturates. And when that case came before the Supreme Court just a few months ago, Scalia voted that the citizens of Oregon did not have the right to give themselves the right to die. So first of all, the guy's a hypocrite. I mean, he comes right out and he says, abortion, gay rights, and the right to die are best left to the legislative and executive branches. You want a right to abortion, pass a law. Well, we did. And Scalia voted to overturn that law. Scalia, Thomas, and John Roberts. Three Catholics strongly opposed to suicide, even legally assisted suicide of any kind, and voting their religious beliefs rather than the law. And now we have Scalito on the court as well, and in all probability he would vote the same way. But the bigger problem with this is that what Scalia is saying essentially is that we derive our rights from the law. And in fact, what the Oregon Death with Dignity Law did was it restricted the power of the federal government to restrict our rights. This is what you have to get. This is such a key and core concept, and that is that the Constitution doesn't give us rights. The Constitution limits the power of government. We the people, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect, etc. We created this document. And we voluntarily give up some of our rights in order to have a society that functions. I give up my right to run a red light in exchange for the right to drive on a public street. There are some trade-offs. I give up my right to steal and to kill in order to be part of civil society. But we voluntarily, we the people, limit those rights through legislation. We pass laws against murder. We pass laws against stealing. We pass laws against running red lights. But the Constitution doesn't grant us rights. Legislation can only limit rights, except in the world of Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. And now, in all probability, John Roberts and Sam Alito. In Scalia's world, and he reaffirmed this yesterday again, and then apparently this is the worldview of the Federalist Society, which is stacking our courts like crazy. In Scalia's world, the government gives us rights. That's how kingdoms work. That's the fundamental notion of a kingdom. The king owns everything, and we are the serfs of the king. We are part, you know, we are the property of the king. And therefore, the king says, well, you can have this right and that right. And that's not how it works in the United States. As Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist Number 84, it has been several times truly remarked that bills of rights are in their origin separations between kings and their subjects. Well, let me share the rest of it with you when we come back from this break. We'll take your calls. It's 16 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour here on the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Let me just wrap this thing up real quickly with Alexander Hamilton in 1787 he was writing this. That was the year they were selling the Constitution, him and James Madison, to the American people, with a few contributions from John Jay and George Mason. But by and large, it was Hamilton and Adams, or Hamilton and Madison, who wrote the Federalist Papers, what we call the Federalist Papers now. It was actually a series of newspaper articles that were published to sell the Constitution. And just throwing this back in the face of Scalia. In the opening sentence of the Constitution, this is Alexander Hamilton. You can read this in Federalist Number 84. You can Google the thing. The opening sentence of the Constitution, we the people created this government, and therefore we the people hold all the rights. Here in the United States, in strictness, the people surrender nothing. And as they retain everything, they have no need of particular reservations of rights. We, the people of the United States, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Here, in the opening sentence of the preamble to the Constitution itself, is a better recognition of popular rights. The truth is, Hamilton wrote, after all the declamations we have heard, the Constitution is itself, in every rational sense and to every useful purpose. And then he writes this in all caps. It's in all capital letters. A Bill of Rights, period. End of quote. So, Mr. Scalia, put that in your pipe and smoke it. Ben Bernanke, we can see he's going to follow in the footsteps of Mr. Greenspan and be another right-wing wacko. He has come out today and said that the way to boost the income of working-class Americans, you'll note if the minimum wage had been indexed to inflation since the 1960s, it would be over $8 right now. Instead, it's just slightly over $5 right now. But Ben Bernanke says that the way to help working-class Americans is to give them a tax break. Yep, give them a tax break, just like you do rich people. That's the way, his actual quote is from Reuters. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said on Wednesday that tax credits might be a better way to boost the income of working class Americans than raising the minimum wage, which he said lowers overall employment. And actually, if you go back, by the way, my friends, if you go back and you look at, and there are a number of websites, you can easily Google this. You go back and look over the last 60, 70 years since there has been a minimum wage. The minimum wage goes back to the 1930s. You look at every year that the minimum wage was increased, employment increased in the years after the minimum wage was increased. Now, why would that be? Because people had more money. They had more money, so they went out and bought more things. Because when you give working people money, they spend all of it. When you give wealthy people money, they stick it in a bank in Switzerland. And so anyhow, they spend more of it, and by spending more of it, they're creating demand for more goods, which causes the factories to run harder, which means says that people have to hire more work. So anyhow, number one, he obviously doesn't understand basic economics 101. I mean, Alan Greenspan didn't have a PhD in economics. Ben Bernanke at least has a degree in economics, but apparently he's been drinking the same Kool-Aid. He said, I think a higher minimum wage does lower employment. However, I note that the literature is very controversial on the subject. Yeah, to say the least. He said, one might consider alternative ways of helping working class Americans. For example, the earned income tax credit, which delivers money to working families without necessarily the employment effect. The employment effect? He also favors free and open international trade. Yeah, let's just ship more jobs over to China. Fine idea, indeed. The Cheney story is getting weirder and weirder as time goes by. It's, I mean, weird is not quite the question has been asked over and over again. What is Cheney trying to cover up? Is he trying to cover up the fact that he was drunk? Is that why there was the 15-hour delay? Is he trying to cover up the fact that maybe this guy was going to die? Maybe they thought this guy was going to die, and they were going to try to cover the whole thing up, and they didn't expect it was ever going to get out. Or is there something else that he's trying to cover up? Well, now it's coming out that there were, if you saw the statement of the woman, Mrs. Armstrong, the woman who owns the ranch, it was on, it's been on the news. She said the three people, and she was driving the car, the other three people got out of the car when they saw the quail to go shoot them. One of them was her friend, Mr. Whittington, the guy who got shot. He's a Texas buddy of hers. The other was Cheney. And the other was Cheney's friend. Now, who was Cheney's friend? Turns out it was Ambassador to Switzerland Pamela Williford. So, was this a double date? People scratching their heads and going, huh? This is a double date? Could it be? Well, have you ever heard of the name of Jennifer Fitzgerald? I have Kitty Kelly's book here. And she's got the photos of Jennifer Fitzgerald. She was the mistress of George Herbert Walker Bush for 20 years. Went with him to China in the 70s, stayed with him until the end of his public career in 1992. Yeah. I mean, FDR died in his mistress's arms down in Warm Springs, Arkansas. Could it have the last vice president to die in office was Rockefeller. He died with his girlfriend. So could it be that Cheney's trying to cover up an affair? I don't know. He's going on Fox News. He's going to talk about it. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll get the straight story there, won't we, my friends? No doubt about it. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Alex, I don't hear any stream. 34 minutes past the hour. There we go. Welcome back. Low-velocity gunshot injuries of joints. This is from the University of Pennsylvania Medical School website. Low-velocity injuries of joints are exceptions to the general trend toward conservative treatments of such wounds. It has been shown that lead. Now, see, this is the fate of people who have a lot of birdshot in them. And it appears that the number 7 birdshot only is available in, or 7.5, I guess, is only available in lead form. So this guy's got a couple hundred pieces of lead in him. It has been shown that lead is dissolved by synovial fluid. Okay, so the synovial fluid is the fluid that surrounds the joints and causes migration of the solute, that is the dissolved lead, to the synovial tissues, the subsynovial tissues, that is the tissues around the joints, resulting in periarticular fibrosis. Now, periarticular is a fancy way of saying the area around the articulation around the joint, around the moving part of the joint, and fibrosis is a fancy way of saying scar tissue. So basically, the lead dissolves in the joint fluid and gets into the tissue and causes scarring. Chronic lead poisoning has also been reported as a delayed complication. Some such findings mandate surgical intervention with removal of the offending bullet fragments as the only appropriate course of action. Yeah, I can. So. You know, when Cheney showed up, I mean, it was one of those...
I've been waiting for you. We meet again at last. The circle is now complete. I am the master.
And to whom was he saying that? Was it to Whittington or was it to Pamela Williford? Is that what he said to George Bush when he finally talked with him a couple of days later? Is that what he's going to say to us? Who knows? I don't know. It's our Cheney alert for the day. It's the strange, strange saga of Deadeye Dick continues. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our chat room, go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat. Greg in Livermore, California on the line. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. This is regarding Bernie Sanders being on C-SPAN today with Ben Bernanke.
Oh, is Bernie drilling this guy?
Yeah, he asked him the question about should we raise the minimum wage, and Bernanke said, oh, I've had seen studies from some Princeton professors who said that jobs go down, so we should increase the earned income tax credit instead.
Did Bernie rip his throat out?
Well, he tried to continue to attack, and Bernanke tried to filibuster so he could get off of Bernie, and Bernie said, I want to get back on the subject, and he also talked about normalized trade status with China, and he said, should we stop that? And Bernanke tried to filibuster that, so...
Oh, interesting, interesting. Yeah. Well, we'll hear Bernie's take on that on Friday. Thanks for the heads up, Greg.
It's pretty good.
I'll have to go look for that clip. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Deborah in St. Cloud, Florida. Hey, Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My comment is that sounds to me like the good old boys in the warmonger were out drinking and having a good time hunting, and possibly Mr. Whittington may have made a comment as far as being flip or seriously against the war in Iraq, and Mr. Cheney took offense to it in a bad way.
Well, Cheney does have a short temper. I mean, he, on the floor of the Senate, told Pat Leahy to go, you know, F himself, and that is something that, to the best of anybody's recollection, has never before been, you know, done. I mean, it's just never been done. And, in fact, I spoke with Pat Leahy in Vermont at a private home a month afterwards, and he said he was shocked. He was, genuinely shy. This was not anything for the cameras or anything. He says, I was just stunned into, like, how do you even reply to something like that? And so, Cheney's got a short temper, and he's been known to behave in ways that are inappropriate. It's interesting, though, this has been my theory for the last couple of days. I've been suggesting that the 15-hour delay had to do with the fact that he was drinking, and that might account for why he was shooting wild. But I was talking with Louise, my wife, about this last night, and this was when we had just found out that the fourth member of the party was a woman, this rather attractive ambassador from Switzerland, a U.S. ambassador from Switzerland, who's a friend of Cheney's. And apparently Williford, I'm mixing him up with Whittington. And Whittington is apparently a friend of the woman who owns the ranch. And so there were two guys and two men and two women out there. And Louise's comment was, his wild shooting was trying to show off. Maybe he was like, I'll get that bird. What do you
think?
I don't know.
All you have to do, though, is look at the guy and know that he has a chip on his shoulder. He's a hard, hard man with not much compassion, as you can tell by all our soldiers being killed in Iraq.
Yeah, which is a true tragedy. Deborah, thanks for the call. Great to hear
from
you.
Thank you.
Mike in La Mattia, California. Am I pronouncing that right, Mike? Hey, Mike.
Yeah.
You're live and on the air. What's up?
Oh, great. Well, 30 yards is a pretty close, with 30 yards apart. You know, on a football field, that's a real close field goal.
Mm-hmm.
He had plenty of, it would be easy for him to not have done what he did. But I understand a New York Times, a reporter went out and took a shotgun and did a target thing and found out that that's pretty strange that he was able to hit this guy this way. But the on the Al Franken show, they had somebody from the Harvard Medical School come on and say that this often happens between young black guys who are acquaintances, and this guy, who have a grudge or whatever. But they said that neither one of these people are black and neither one of them are young. But they're doing DNA tests now, so we don't know for sure that maybe one of these guys might be black.
Oh, jeez.
So we really don't know.
Yeah, okay, Mike, thanks. Thanks a lot. I mean, that's just too weird. I don't even know what to say to that. That's just too weird. I'm sorry. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. That was weird. Yeah, and as Dick Gate comes on the heels of...
Dick Gate. I love it.
the phony pre-war intelligence that's boiling. That's the real Dick point.
That's the real Dick gate. This guy, Paul Pillar from the CIA, who is the head of the CIA's operation in the Near East, which is Afghanistan and Iraq, comes out last week and says Cheney made this stuff up about the connection between 9/11. And by the way, today now, ABC is running this thing about, well, we've translated tapes from Saddam's palaces from 10 years ago, and he's talking about an attack on America. Well, everybody in the Middle East was talking about attacks on America. He was speculating.
But they're
spinning it like, let's help Mr. Cheney here or something. What's the deal with ABC? I don't get it. And who gave him those tapes?
That's right. And forgive me for not knowing the title of this article, but it must have been on Raw Story or Truth Out or one of those websites that alleged that Karl Rove had called the ranch and coached Karen Armstrong, before they went to
the local paper.
That's right. Did you hear that too?
No, I didn't, but it wouldn't surprise me.
These bits are coming out, and it's looking creepier and creepier. I mean, Cheney's a creepy, slimy troll anyways. And he needs to be. Bush and Cheney are just so awful for the country. And the points that you brought up with Scalia in calling whoever an idiot for considering the Constitution as a living document, that guy needs to be dealt with. I mean, all of those Supreme Court judges who voted for Bush, look what happened.
Yeah, and I'm assuming by dealt with you mean something like impeached, advocating any kind of violence.
I mean, the liberal progressive talk shows should just be all over them because they're in these lifetime positions. I don't like the fact that they're in lifetime positions to act, to legislate.
Yeah, but the reality is, David, that the Supreme Court is vulnerable to public pressure. They really are. The fact of the matter is that in 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education was decided, it was a surprise to some. But a lot of people were not surprised by Brown versus Board of Education because the civil rights movement was getting traction. And the Supreme Court, and the same thing, by the way, Dred Scott, I mean, you could flip that all the way back, the Supreme Court affirming slavery. The Supreme Court doesn't lead the law. The Supreme Court reflects the law. The Supreme Court reflects public opinion, by and large, or at least what's perceived as public opinion. And so if enough Americans are speaking out loudly enough, I believe it's actually possible to influence the Supreme Court, and I believe that history shows that it's happened many, many times. David, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Good talking with you. John in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, John.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to comment about Dick Cheney, and it was brought to light to me, not through the news media, but right after 9/11, he was out pheasant hunting in South Dakota, and he had a little mishap out there also. Secret Service totaled out one of their vehicles while trying to protect him. Nothing was ever brought into the news media about that, and I wonder why.
Oh, that's interesting. What was the incident?
It happened out in South Dakota right after 9/11. He was out pheasant hunting. It was brought to my attention by a friend of mine that lives out there. And if the news media would look into it, I'm sure they could bring some up on it and find out that it's true.
That's interesting. David's making a note here. South Dakota, right after 9/11, Dick Cheney, hunting incident. Interesting. Denise in Gainesville, Florida. Denise, we have about 20 seconds. What's up? Denise?
Yes? Oh, hey. I was just going to comment about your wife's comment about the testosterone loaded shooting incident.
Uh-huh.
And to say that my experience is that this kind of boyish pranks occur more often when there's drinking involved, and so possibly
a little testosterone and a little alcohol. Yeah, it's a bad mixture. It's a bad mixture.
Deadly mixture.
Yeah, we've seen it over and over again. Denise, thank you for the call, and thank you for making that point. It's a good one. Yeah, who knows? I mean, we'll see. I'm going to be really interested to see if Dick Cheney gets asked by Fox News if he was drunk. Or if he had a girlfriend there. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
trying to make ends meet. He's gotta pay his credit cards.
And welcome back, my friends. It's 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, here's the story. This from September 2002. Vice President Dick Cheney arrived in South Dakota Monday on his annual pheasant hunting trip. This is the fourth year of pheasant. He shot pheasants. Prices. In 2001, two Secret Service agents were in accidents during Cheney's stay at a Sully County lodge. One accident involved the rollover of a large sport utility vehicle on a gravel road. The vice president was not riding with either of the agents. Well, that's interesting. Was he shooting at them? Who knows? Who knows? And this now from Raw Story, an article on MSNBC's website was edited to remove references to alcohol that may have been available at a picnic which preceded the accidental shooting of a 78-year-old lawyer by Vice President Cheney last Saturday. The change Raw Story has learned. This article by Ron Breinart. The change to the article was quickly noticed by a number of bloggers and their readers, many of whom have been following this much-discussed story. In the article credited to Aram Ronson and the NBC investigative unit, Catherine Armstrong, a member of the family who owns the ranch, revealed new details about her lobbying for the Bush administration and about circumstances surrounding the incident itself, which wasn't reported, and, you know, et cetera. The following paragraph was removed for unknown reasons. Armstrong also told NBC News that she does not believe alcohol was involved in the accident. She says she believes no one that day was drinking, although she says there may have been beer available during a picnic lunch that preceded the incident. She said, quote, there may be a beer or two in there, but remember, not everybody in the party was shooting. End quote. Catherine Armstrong, wealthy Republican lobbyist. So we'll see how this thing plays out. Patrick in Albany, New York. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, I'm here. What's happening with you?
Nothing. I just want to say this couldn't have happened to a better guy, you know, the whole Dick Cheney shooting incident.
Well, in a way, it's actually working to his benefit tremendously, because last week two stories came out that in both cases he was accused of indictable felonious activities. One, Scooter Libby, who worked for him, said that it was Dick Cheney who told him to release national secrets in violation of the National Secrets Act, which is also known as, according to President Bush Sr., treason. And number two, this Paul Pillar, the guy who was the head of the CIA's Near East station, said that he had told Cheney that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. Or Saddam Hussein and Osama, or any of that, and the Cheney went ahead and kept saying it anyway. And in other words, he lied to us and he lied to Congress.
Listen, I'm not gonna pick no bones about it. I'm gonna let you know right now, I'm a Republican, and I'll say it right now, it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I grew up with the values of the old Republican Party, of fiscal discipline, you know, not interfering with the Constitution. Things such as that nature, you know.
Yeah.
I was never really a big fan of nation building or preemptive strike. Or, I mean, in my opinion, man, if we're going to go over there and help these people, if they came over here, they would kill all of us.
Well, it was the Republican Party, you know, that fought the Democratic Party in getting into World War II. It was the Republican Party that fought Woodrow Wilson in getting into World War I. It was the Republican Party for years and years that said, no, I'm supporting you here, Patrick. It was the Republican Party for years and years that said that it is not the job of the United States to be the policeman of the world.
Yep. Okay.
And that's what Bush is doing. I mean, ultimately, the Republicans came around with World War I and World War II in both cases. But in both cases, I mean, historically, the Republican Party has been a party that said, we're going to leave the world alone, let the world leave us alone, we're going to, you know, let's mind our own knitting here.
Okay. Yep,
and these guys are not Republicans.
You're right, exactly. The truth is, George Bush and Dick Cheney, they were never really Republicans. They represent, I don't know what the hell they represent. They represent this weird, I feel like my party's been taken over by, like, religious people, and it really back me and my father. My father always, you know, he loves the party. He will never abandon it, no matter what. But
yeah.
I'm starting to think, I mean, after you shooting this guy in the face, it's pretty much up.
You know, Patrick, I talked with Jim Jeffords after he left, you know, in Vermont when he left that party, and he said, leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me. I'm paraphrasing, but it changed out from underneath me. I just, on my morning show this morning on KPOJ here in Portland, Oregon, interviewed State Senator Ben Westland, who has now declared that he is running as governor for the state of Oregon. He's a Republican state senator, and he just left the Republican Party this morning on our program in order to run as an independent for the governorship of Oregon. And I'm thinking of endorsing the guy. I mean, the guy's really good. And there are some very good Republicans out there, but I'm telling you, as you said, the party has been taken over by weirdos and wackos, and it's a tragedy. I got to move along, Patrick. Thanks for the call.
One more thing.
Sure. Okay.
One more thing.
Go for it.
I know you guys, I listen to this radio thing over here. You guys are bashing us left and right. Fox News and all these guys that are coming out with all this stupid stuff. But there are a lot of bad Republicans. But let me tell you right now, there are a lot of good ones, too. And
I agree with you.
I mean, it's
I'd like to, you know, I've had Ron Paul on this program a couple of times. I mean, you know, he's a decent guy. He really believes in the old values of the Republican Party.
What a great Republican Party.
Yeah, you got Lou Dobbs out there. He's a Republican in the media, you know, openly a Republican on CNN talking about some of these issues. I mean, there are some decent Republicans out there. I agree with you, Patrick, and thank you for saying it. Dave in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Dave, we got about a minute. What's up?
Yeah, my question was having to do with whether the vice president should have gone to the emergency room, and I assume you were just poking fun that you wouldn't really want the vice president and his entourage in the emergency room during that time, disrupting the whole hospital. Was that
No, I never said that he should have been, or I never said that he shouldn't have been, so I think you might be thinking about some other show. Of course, you wouldn't want the vice president. That would be a mess. No, but I do think that when the police show up and say, hey, listen, there's been a shooting, we'd like to interview you, you don't say, come back in 15 hours when I've sobered up. Come back in 15 hours. You just don't say that. But that's what Cheney said to the cops. He said, come back in 15 hours. We'll see you in the morning. I got to get a good night's sleep. 57 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Injustice anywhere, said Martin Luther King Jr. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Sort of a John Donne character to our quote for the day there from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome back to the program. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. Jeffrey, one of the nation's leading experts in framing. His website, frameshopisopen.com. Be sure and put the is open in there. frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is open. Jeffrey, you've got a couple of frames here that I find fascinating that have to do with how the Bush administration is dealing with the flood victims and how we should be framing or reframing it. Trickle down, business experiments, people first. Tell me about these.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, this week there have been there were testimonies in front of Congress. You know, Mike Brown was talking in front of Congress and defending himself. In terms of what happened in Hurricane Katrina. And so I started to just look over on the website, the White House website, to see what they were doing in terms of trying to misdirect the public on what actually happened and what hurricane relief really is. And I noticed something really interesting, which is that on the webpage at the White House, which is dedicated to talking about the relief efforts for people who are suffering under Hurricane Katrina, there were something like 25 times that the word business was mentioned as compared to the word people being mentioned only three times.
Whoa.
It's really remarkable. And what happened on Monday was that the subsidies for people who were displaced by the hurricane, who were living in hotels, FEMA had put in place a whole bunch of subsidies to help these people get by, and they were being removed from them. And so people were essentially being cast out onto the street, and the FEMA direct help for people was pretty much coming to an end. It's really interesting because it seems that what the White House has done is they are using trickle-down economics to help the hurricane victims rather than simply going directly to the people and helping themselves. The theory seems to be that if you help, that government should help local business in times of disaster, and that eventually, farther down the road, as a result of businesses creating new jobs and so forth, those businesses will help the people. And if the people don't find that help, then it's their own fault. So there's all kinds of things like tax incentives for local businesses to create opportunities for people. But the number of things that go directly into those people displaced by all those floods are minimal.
And what's so weird is that if you simply gave the money to the people who were displaced by the floods, they would spend it, and you'd see an explosion of business activity.
Exactly. But instead of giving them money, they, you know, in a few instances, people have come up with a voucher program, you know, giving people who have absolutely nothing, who are carrying their entire life possessions in a few plastic bags around, give them a voucher so they can go out and, in the language of the White House, responsibly get themselves back up on their feet. I mean, we're talking about people who need a total spectrum of assistance still. And this is 10,000 people who are cast out onto the street all over the country. There are even some people here in New York City.
Yeah, minimally 10,000. And it shouldn't surprise us, I suppose, because the philosophy of the Bush administration and of this brand of hyper-conservative that has been around really since the so-called Reagan Revolution is that what they're all about, that the purpose, in their minds, the purpose of government is to serve a very specific class of persons in this society, and then they kind of dress that up with this theory that if they serve that class of persons, then that will benefit society. And that class of persons, of course, are people of inherited wealth or people who run businesses, corporate power, and that category is, let's say, the rich, broadly speaking.
Exactly. And, I mean, it's a society governed by a noble aristocracy, and they serve a really important role in this Republican vision, because without this noble aristocracy constantly being catered to by the government, who would we, the little people, have to aspire to?
And Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, this is the classic conservative worldview. I mean, a lot of Americans may be shocked to hear this, but you go back and you read John Adams, the second president of the United States, the first conservative president of the United States, and he talked about the dangers of allowing the rabble, you know, you and me, the average person, having too much of a say in government. He strongly argued against, for example, the Senate being directly elected by the people, while Jefferson, who was the founder of the modern-day Democratic Party, was arguing in favor of the Senate being elected by the people. Jefferson lost that argument, by the way, until 1917, I think it was, or 1913, 17th Amendment, or 1917 and 13th, I mix them up, but anyhow, back then. And when we started directly electing the Senate. So we've got this aristocracy, this noble aristocracy that this stuff is going to trickle down to. And you suggest that we need to explicitly frame this for them.
Absolutely. I mean, we need to use phrases. For example, we need to say that trickle-down economics is no help for flood victims. I think that's a logical way to put this out in front of people. We need to talk about the fact that the Bush administration is trying business experiments to help people and say instead, you know, people need real help, not business experiments. And we need to talk about putting people first. FEMA should put people first and private sector schemes second. Literally bring these problems, these weaknesses in the Bush relief effort directly in front of the American people.
And do it in a way that's very simple and easy to understand.
Absolutely.
Another thing I find mind-boggling is that in Hope, Arkansas, Bill Clinton's hometown, to add irony to this thing, there is something like 1,000, well over 1,000, they're not quite mobile, prefabricated houses that are rusting and breaking into the mud because they're on the wrong kinds of frames that were paid for by FEMA to the tune of several hundred million dollars. And the reason why they can't be put into Mississippi is because the regulations say that you can't put these things in a floodplain. But that's not, excuse me, in Louisiana. But that's not the Louisiana law. That's the FEMA law. So FEMA has a regulation that says you can't put a mobile home or whatever, these things, prefabricated house, into a floodplain. And then FEMA goes out and buys $300-400 million worth of these things from some crony of the Bush administration. And then they're sitting there being ruined while there's people living in tents on their houses, on their property.
It's unbelievable. And this type of discussion is really going to be intense in this coming week, because you're going to see Michael Chertoff go up in front of the same commission that was interviewing Brown. And Chertoff is going to have all kinds of excuses that he's going to lay out about that FEMA was acting in the best interests of the states, and that it was really the state governor and the mayor on the scene who were causing the problems. But what Democrats need to do, they need to be very careful not to get drawn up into this legalese about the relationship between the federal government and the states. They need to very simply state that Bush broke FEMA. He broke FEMA when he set up the Homeland Security Department, and they knew it was broken, and because it was broken, people died in Louisiana. I think that the great risk of the Democrats face over these Chertoff hearings is that they'll be drawn into these, you know, very difficult and complicated arguments about legislative policy and practice, and they just need to say that Bush broke FEMA.
Well, the other way, isn't it true, Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, isn't it true that the other way that Bush broke FEMA was by appointing cronies and political hacks to head FEMA and kicking out professional disaster relief guys like the fellow who was running it under Bill Clinton?
Absolutely. I mean, horse experts
James Lee Witt
Brown can't save lives.
Yeah, and whereas James Lee Witt had been running it under Clinton, and Witt had a lifetime of experience in working with disasters.
Absolutely, and as a result of that experience, he was able to plan and see what was coming ahead.
Right.
And that was what's so remarkably cynical about Brown's his testimony in front of the Senate, in which he essentially attacked people for not helping him fast enough when it was his job to anticipate what was going on. But his expertise was not saving lives, was not anticipating disasters. It was fundraising in the Republican Party, and that's what got him the job.
Right. I think that, Jeffrey Feldman, we could also tie this to Iraq, because the Iraq economy is now in shambles because the Bush administration went in and rewrote their constitution and tried to inflict conservative economics on Iraq with free trade, open borders, flat taxes, all these things. Again, another experiment, another business experiment.
Exactly. Destroy the infrastructure, but then give them business incentives.
Yeah, and trickle down economics. It's no help for flood victims. It's also no help for Iraq. The business experiment, the people need real help. They do in Iraq as well, as well as in New Orleans, not business experiments, and this is an experiment. And people first, these three frames that you're putting out. FEMA should put people first and private sector schemes second, and perhaps in Iraq if we want to. This is one of the problems, is that the nonprofits in Iran are in Iraq building schools, building mosques, building hospitals, building food distribution centers, and getting a whole lot of political traction. I mean, it's what Hamas did in the Middle East.
Exactly.
So we're just going about this all backwards. And you know, well, I guess what do you expect from the Bushies? Anyhow, Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief of frameshopisopen.com. Check it out. Jeffrey, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Telling the truth that multinational corporations would, well, you know, really rather you didn't know about.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Have you forgot?
6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, where is Osama bin Laden? He said, I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned.
Mr. President.
I don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations.
And, you know, again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
You know, they don't want to forget the feeling of horror, but they want to forget that the...
The U.S. has dropped the ball. Bin Laden is still a free man.
And you say we shouldn't worry about Bin Laden. And we vow to get Bin Laden. Have you forgotten?
Well,
think that it's much broader.
And welcome back, my friends.
This is a warning.
21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Ellen Ratner's with us at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
How you doing? There's so much news today, I don't know where to start, but let me go quickly.
How about at the beginning?
Mr. Bernanke, the new Fed chair, said that...
mixing it up with Bernie Sanders.
I'm sorry?
Mixing it up with Bernie Sanders.
Mixing it up with Bernie Sanders and saying, I mean, what's so amazing is he's talking about why they may need to raise interest rates, and then the next 2 minutes he goes and says that there's all these other indicators that there's a slowing housing market, et cetera, things that, of course, affect regular people.
Right. Yeah. Well, although he's not so concerned about regular people, he doesn't think, for example, that the minimum wage should be increased.
Well, that's right. Well, which is why he would rather raise the interest rates, even though the people who are buying houses are middle class people who don't have mega bucks and who need a lower interest rate to buy houses. Of course, you raise their interest rates, the housing market's going to slow.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. Rocket science.
No, it's not.
As you know, the vice president is now going to be doing, actually it's happening today at 2, he's doing an interview with Fox News Channel, and he is going to be talking to Brit Hume. It's going to be aired tonight on Brit Hume's show, and this is going to be his first interview since the shooting.
Now, what do you want to, I don't know if you're a betting woman here, Ellen, or not, but I would place bets that, number one, Brit Hume will not ask him if he was drinking, and number two, the fact that there were two men and two women on this party and nobody else, and that one of the women was a friend of Mr. Whittington's, the woman who runs the ranch, and the other woman was a friend of Mr. Cheney's, I'll bet that Brit Hume also won't ask him, was this a double date?
Well, knowing the vice president as I know, and I don't think that's the kind of thing he's into. The drinking, I have certainly raised that question.
Yeah.
Many times. A couple other interesting things. The president is now announced today through Condoleezza Rice, when she was before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that they're requesting $75 million to promote democracy in Iran. How are they going to do this? They're going to do this through, you know, essentially radio Farsi or one of those kind of things through the Broadcasting Board of Governors. That's been very successful, as we've noted, in the Middle East.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, here's the ironic thing, Ellen. In the past, when America actually was a beacon of democracy to the world, I mean, setting aside the time when we were in Vietnam, but if you look through the period of after the 40s, the 1950s, the early 1960s, and frankly, into the late 70s and throughout the 80s, Voice of America was a powerful force for democracy around the world. It did help break up the Soviet Union. It did help bring independence movements into being, from China to former Soviet Georgia. And the tragedy is now that we no longer have that moral force. I mean, these pictures came out today.
No, we certainly don't. I mean, yes, my brother Michael was informed of the new Abu Ghraib pictures last night, and of course, if you look at them, they're just...
I saw them this morning. The Sydney Morning Herald has published them.
By the way, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael's organization, is coming out with a book on impeachment.
Oh, really?
Next week, I believe. We'll make sure you get a fast copy of it.
Yeah, and I'd love to get him on the program and talk about it.
Oh, well, I'm sure you will. I'm sure I can arrange that.
Well, thank you.
A couple other interesting things today, of course, were the hearings. And Susan Collins, who, by the way, has been asked to advise none other than Senator, why am I blocking on his name?
Well, we should add for our listeners.
Senator McCain.
Yeah, Susan Collins, the moderate Republican senator from Maine.
Has been asked to advise Senator McCain if he runs for president.
Oh, interesting.
She really did rip into Secretary Chertoff today. It wasn't pretty, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
She basically said that there was absolutely no communication with FEMA, that she said the problem with the Department of Homeland Security goes beyond its relationship with FEMA. She called it their overall lack of preparedness, and she criticized him for going to a conference on bird flu in Atlanta. I mean, she did let it rip.
We need to be reciting. Jeffrey Feldman, Frame Shop is open, was just on the program, and he suggested we need to be reciting like a mantra. Bush broke FEMA. FEMA was working just fine. Bush broke it. He broke it by incorporating it into the Homeland Security Department and removing it from being a cabinet-level agency, number one, and he broke it, number two, by putting in charge of it political cronies whose only Joe Alba and Brownie, whose only credential was that they could raise money for Republicans.
Right. I mean, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, FEMA 1 was a mess. I mean, FEMA under Bush 1 was a mess. Clinton really fixed it.
Yeah.
And look what happened.
Yeah, he put a guy, James Lee Witt, who actually knew about disaster control, in charge of it. And, yeah, exactly. Look what happened. Ellen Rander, TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Ellen, for today's report. Good talking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain, my friends.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Katrina blew through the town like waters flooded all around. No money to raise levees high, and so we watched New Orleans die. Bill Clinton was a Democrat. He saved us money in his hat. He fell from grace, the story goes. Then Georgie put us in the hole.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where we know that...
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Is wrong. Welcome back to our program. Yes, it's time for news from the weird. Neoconservative pundit Fred Barnes reports in his new book, this is from the Progress Report, in his new book, Rebel in Chief, that President Bush, quote, fundamentally doesn't accept the theory of global warming, and was reinforced in that belief by a meeting not with any scientist, but rather with novelist Michael Crichton, whose novel State of Fear revolves around the issue. This is... Are you getting this? George W. Bush is getting his advice on global warming from a novelist, from Michael Crichton. Well, yes, not Michael Crichton, did graduate from medical school, didn't finish his work to get his MDs, but maybe he is an MD, but he's not licensed as a physician. But in any case, he's a novelist. The guy writes novels. And even more disturbing is that President Bush would receive his science advice from a novelist whose latest book is about a corrupt scientist. Now, this is the plot line of Michael Crichton's most recent novel, about a corrupt scientist who invents false data about global warming to help raise funds for his projects, then contracts a group of global terrorists to create a series of floods, tsunamis, and other natural disasters to prove his point. The bad news is this book's science is apparently even worse than its plot. And the strange news is that this is the guy to whom George W. Bush, according to the conservative, according to Fred Barnes, this conservative pundit, this is the guy that George W. Bush has turned to for advice on global warming. It just doesn't get any stranger than that, my friends. The Venezuelan government, by the way, has given a Christian missionary group from the U.S. until Sunday to leave the country. Now, some folks may listen to this, hear this, whatever, and go, what, is Chavez anti-Christian? No. This group is called New Tribes Mission. I wrote about them in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. President Hugo Chavez has repeatedly called for the expulsion of New Tribes Mission. What New Tribes Mission is all about is finding indigenous people and converting them to not just to Christianity, but also to our modern worldview. And, in fact, it's interesting. I used to get their newsletter, and there would always be these prayer requests for, you know, help us convert these heathen, right? The whole idea is that if every single person in the world can be converted to Christianity, then Jesus will return. And for the past 60 years, this group, which is based out of Florida, has been trying to convert indigenous groups in Venezuela into Christianity. The biggest problem that they have is convincing indigenous people that they are sinful and in need of salvation, which is, you know, one of the fundamental tenets of Christianity. Because the people are going, I didn't know that we were born sinful. I didn't know that we were born with God angry with us. I don't get it. And frankly, a lot of Christians don't quite get that. I don't get it. You know, it's I have to say I share the bafflement of the indigenous people. in this whole idea that you're doomed. You're doomed. Joy in Cincinnati, welcome to the program. Hey, Joy.
Hello, Tom. I think there's an elephant in the room that the media is ignoring. The second British memo where Bush told Tony Blair that he was afraid they wouldn't find weapons.
Oh, you're right. And let's paint a plane to look like the UN plane.
Yeah. This
got blown up by the Cheney story, too. You know, Cheney shooting this guy has helped them so much.
I think that's terrible. I mean, that he wanted to go to war that bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lincoln Chafee, he didn't vote for Bush. He's a Republican. I think it's on account of the war.
Yeah.
You know, he just, because he said Bush was going with or without Congress.
Yes.
So, I just think it's shameful how bad he wanted to go to war.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's it's really, really quite remarkable. Joy, thanks for reminding me of that. We did that story when it happened, and it's amazing. So much stuff has been flying by. The corruption and just absolute, utter, bizarre, illegal, out-of-control behavior of this administration. And, of course, what makes the talk shows, what makes the news circuit, what makes Rita Cosby or whatever, what is she, Bing's granddaughter or something, on CNN is Cheney finally shoots somebody. So that gets the news cycle, right? Because it's a simple story. People can get it. People can understand it. Dick in Dayton, Ohio, from Ohio to Ohio. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
I'm fine.
Hey, Tom, I want to say something about this hunting thing that my dad was a hunter here in Ohio and had a little dog. But I think it's for a sport, and I think we should have the guns, the people, the law enforcement people, them use them. And I think to carry something, say, in the car, it's against the laws of society. That's my opinion of it.
So you think that these guys who go to these 50,000-acre ranches and pay $1,000 a day to be driven around to where the quail are hanging out and they hop out of the car with a gun and shoot them, you think that that's not sporting?
Right. That's the way I think.
And
you have to be very, very careful on what you do, buddy.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick. Thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah.
Good to hear from you. Don in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm just really appalled at the inequity of the issue with Cheney and his failure to report the incident in a timely manner.
Yeah. I think most of America is appalled by that, Don. I mean, you have the press secretaries for three previous Republican presidents coming out and saying that they're appalled by it.
Yeah. Usually in a situation like that, there's drinking involved.
Yeah.
If this were an auto accident and you didn't report it, well, probably because you didn't want a DUI or something associated with it.
Well, it's the same thing with shooting accidents. I mean, if you accidentally shoot somebody in the woods and you wait 24 hours to report it, or in this case 15 hours to report it, or to be interviewed by the police, let's say, it actually got reported fairly quickly, but because they had to go to a hospital, and the police were notified. But when the police showed up to interview Cheney a few hours after the incident, he said, "Come back tomorrow morning." 15 hours later.
And then they didn't really have the right stamps and whatnot for their license to be legal either.
Yeah. So there's the issue of the fact that the guy was a poacher.
If you or I were doing that, we'd probably be in jail or have had to pay some bail.
Well, you got to understand, Don, that these guys live in a parallel universe. They live in a separate world from you or I. They show up at these places where they spend anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars a day to sleep on big feather beds and eat 5-course meals or 10-course meals with the finest wines and get driven around in gold-plated SUVs to hop out and shoot something, and they just figure that the hunting lodge is going to take care of all that. It's going to get the stamps for them. They've got people to do that kind of stuff for them. So it's a parallel universe that they live in.
Another interesting question is, who was the third person in that hunting party?
Oh, I can tell you that. It was Patricia Whittington. She's the U.S. ambassador to Switzerland. And she's an old friend of Cheney's.
Oh, okay.
So scratch your head on that. Was this a double date? I don't know. Got to move along. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Patricia in Sacramento. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I want to kind of switch over back to what you just left with on the last segment, in touch with privatization of Iraq.
Yes.
I know you have, but a lot of other talk show hosts haven't been focusing on this. And I wonder if you could add on to this, but it all began with Paul Bremer's 100 orders.
That's right.
Completely privatized everything. Then you have Presidential Executive Order 13303 that gave corporations basically immunity from the law. You have Bechtel that's conducting this huge privatization of the water there. In addition, we all know about the private security companies that we have there.
That's the second largest army in Iraq.
Absolutely. And
almost 30,000 people.
Well, how I wanted to tie this, it was kind of into Katrina, meaning I think we saw with the disaster in Katrina how Halliburton got the contracts once again. We were using private security companies on the ground there in New Orleans.
Yeah, the same one, in fact, Blackwater.
Blackwater, exactly. And so my theory on this, Tom, is I agree with you that it's really not necessarily the oil. I think that was just kind of an added feature.
Yeah.
But I think they needed to attack a nation that the public could possibly say, God, Saddam is dangerous. But at the same time, them knowing that we'd be able to attack them and they could not fight back.
Well, I think it goes beyond that even, Patricia. I think that in part that there was, Bush did this to get political capital. I mean, clearly the timing was organized to affect electoral politics here in the United States. But I think the neocon position on this, and the reason why the neocons have been pushing for this ever since the late 90s, was that they wanted to take, they have been fighting with Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, really, ever since World War II ended. Harry Truman, in 1947, tried to get national health care. The Republicans had taken control of the House and Senate, and they shot it down, and they wouldn't let it happen. But he proposed the first nationally funded, single-payer national health care program, would have put all the health insurance companies out of business. And they've been fighting this ever since then. And so Harry Truman said, we'll prove that it works, and we'll do it in Japan and China and Germany. And sure enough, it worked. And, strong unions and all these other things. And so the neocons have been wanting to have a country where they can do their super conservative experiment and they can say, see, it works. And it never has worked in the history of the world, and it didn't work in Iraq.
Tom, if I may ask you just one quick additional question. I read in the BBC a few days ago that, we know about Iran threatening us using the trading in the euro versus trading in the dollar.
Yeah.
Do you know for a fact, are they doing it as of now? Or
they say that they are going to start an oil bourse, that is an oil trading floor, in March. And and I saw a news story this morning, or I saw a piece fly by on the web that Syria has begun denominating its some of its international currency, international trades in euros. And of course, that's what Saddam did just before we attacked him. Was he said he was going to start denominating the sale of his oil in euros. So March is the time to watch, Patricia, if you're a subscriber to the theory that we're going after them because they could blow the dollar out of the water. Which, by the way, does make a certain amount of sense to me. I'm not discounting that at all. Patricia, thanks a lot for the
Thank
calls.
You.
45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio program, the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In the chat room, one of the folks mentioned that the quail wings that Cheney was shooting were clipped. So they couldn't fly very high or very far. I'm just sitting here talking with David Poole, our producer, during the break. David is a hunter or has hunted, and I've never been hunting. I've been fishing. Not something that I do anymore. I did when I was a kid. I can understand somebody hunting to eat. I mean, that's the way humans have lived for hundreds of thousands of years. I can understand even somebody feeling a lot of satisfaction out of that. But I can't understand somebody just killing things for the joy of killing. I mean, I think by and large, when we find people who kill for the pleasure of killing and nothing else, we refer them to psychiatrists. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Kit in Seattle. Hey, Kit, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Say, I'm an avid 1090 listener, but... every now and then I cruise the talk radio.
Fall off to the dark side?
Yeah, it's interesting. I never really hear anything enlightening, but I was listening to O'Reilly, and he was very clear about Chernoff being the fall guy for this last week.
Yeah, Chertoff. Yeah. Oh, well, it's been coming. I mean, it's because the Bush administration is really who's responsible for this thing. But, I mean, you know, for breaking FEMA, number one, for making FEMA no longer a cabinet-level, position and all that sort of thing. Yeah. But
when did you find out about Chernoff?
Chertoff?
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean about him? That he was going to be the fall guy?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was fairly apparent, you know, as soon as Brownie started, you know, got out of the line of fire and became obvious that the Republicans were going to investigate this thing. The only way it could go is to Chertoff. He's the guy above Brownie and below Bush. So Bush is not going to take responsibility, and the Republicans are going to pursue an investigation. As soon as they announced that they were going to pursue an investigation, it was obvious, I think, to everybody that Chertoff was going to be the next to go.
Well, O'Reilly seemed to be very clear that this was going to be the end of this big controversy. Chernoff would take the fall, and then Bush would come out clean, and he was sounding kind of smug about it. It seems to me these guys are like a straight pipeline of propaganda. Like they got, you know, they know what's going on before the news is released.
Yeah, it's very, yeah, well, I it could be. Could be, kid, or it could be just that, he was using the same logic that I was, but who knows? I mean, the search for scapegoats is ongoing. By the way, this from and thanks for the call, Kit. This from the Huffington Post, Bob Keska. Sirius Radio's Alex Benick just broke a rumor that the delay in Alex is on the radio on Sirius just before I am on Sirius Left. Just broke a rumor that the delay in reporting the news that Cheney shot an old man in the heart was due to an effort to hide or spin Cheney's female companion, Pamela Williford, shown right, ambassador to Switzerland, and yes, Liechtenstein, was part of the hunting excursion with Cheney and Whittington. And according to Williford's account, Cheney and the ambassador were side by side when the shooting took place. The vice president's Secret Service detail had to decide what to do with Williford by way of perhaps covering up a relationship with Cheney, and thus the delay in reporting the news. The rumor goes that Lynn Cheney isn't happy with Cheney's close relationship with Williford. Again, just a rumor. So, what do you know? Susan in Seattle. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Oh, the plot thickens.
Oh, it continuously.
Crazy. Yeah, I had a question because a few minutes ago, one of your callers asked who was the third witness there at the shooting, and you said the name Patricia Whittington. So that's one reason I was calling.
I was mixing up the names.
Yeah, I figured it was Pamela Williford. And I had mentioned earlier to someone there at your thing that why is it on the Texas Parks and Wildlife Hunting Accident and Incident Report form, which they posted on the CNN website, why is it that Catherine Armstrong is the only listed witness there? I mean, I'm just curious, right? I mean,
yeah, they're trying to cover up Pamela Williford being there, you mean?
Yeah, I just haven't until today, I guess, until this morning, I didn't see anything or hear anything about that, and I'm glad, you know, maybe people are starting to ask some questions.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
don't bet on Fox News to do it, but people are starting to ask questions.
Anyway, I just want to clear that up, and obviously that just came up.
Yeah,
last few minutes.
Thank you.
Got that. Thanks.
Yep, thanks, Susan. Great to hear from you. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I just wanted to refer to, you were talking about Fred Barnes promoting his book.
Yeah.
Rebel in Chief.
Well, what was interesting about it was that in his book, he says that Bush is getting his advice on global warming from Michael Crichton, you know, of all people.
Right.
Yeah, from a novelist.
Yeah,
and that he's taking it seriously, apparently.
Right. Well, I got him on Minnesota Public Radio. He was on there, and right out of the box, I asked him, I said, hey, Fred, can you tell me, is Sweden and France, are they socialist countries?
And what do you say?
He starts hemming and hawing. And, well, Sweden is full-blown socialist, and then France is sort of halfway there, blah, blah, blah. And so I said, yeah, the reason I ask you that, Fred, is because you cons intentionally try to use that loaded word to confuse your dorky listeners that Sweden is, like, let me educate you. Sweden is a freely elected democracy with regulated markets, millions of private businesses, and you think rules mean Marxist tyranny.
Yeah.
And you use that socialist...
Well, they really do think that, though, Tom. And the problem is they're just not honest about it.
Yeah,
they just don't say it out loud.
Listeners think that. That's why your guy, Witt, who always calls in, says socialist. He has no idea what that word means.
Right, yeah.
It's just incredible. And I always have to nail him on that because when you go to your guy, Andrew, what's that, the Ann Rand
Andrew Bernstein,
guy,
yeah.
capitalist.org. I went there, checked it out. He's always trying to redefine the economic term capitalism as in system of individual rights.
Right, and it's not. No, it's not. It's capitalism means that you can earn money with money. You can use capital to generate more capital. Yeah, Tom, thanks a lot for the call. It's a good point. And language is important. Language is very important. In fact, language is one of the most powerful tools that the cons use to keep America conned. Exposing the con in conservative. This is Tom Hartman here with you. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the program, other programs referred to as Show Prep. It's Tom Hartman here with you. David Sirota is with us, workingforchange.com, his website. David is formerly a fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of Hostile Takeover, a new book. He also produces the online magazine at workingforchange.com. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Great. I wanted to talk to you about this situation with regard to Paul Hackett and Sherrod Brown, because it came up yesterday on the program, and my first take on it was that I thought that it was a shame that Hackett had basically said, I'm not going to play in politics anymore, because he was a good guy and we need people like him, which is, I think, what Howard Dean basically came out and said today. But I didn't know much about Sherrod Brown. I got an email from one of our Ohio listeners, Joe in Akron, who says, regarding Hackett, his opponent is my congressman. Sherrod Brown is a member of the Progressive Caucus, has a proven track record. Although we sympathize with Hackett, we want an Ohio senator that has a proven progressive, not just a war hero who seeks publicity. Now, that sounds a bit like a whack at Hackett. I don't mean to do that, but, you know, you've spent some time looking into this situation. You've written about it at some length, and I'm just wondering, what's going on here?
Well, I think it was too bad that the two of them, Hackett and Brown, ended up in a potential primary against each other. I think that what happened was really the dynamics of this race was, I think that Hackett tried to ramrod it into a sort of insider outsider dichotomy, a sort of progressive versus conservative dichotomy, and I think that he basically was unable to gain any traction on that. Mainly because that reality didn't exist. To call Sherrod Brown an insider, a sort of, you know, one of these sort of members of the club, is totally ridiculous. I mean, just as one example, I mean, Sherrod Brown, not only a member of the Progressive Caucus, but he's been one of the few consistent, long-term, outspoken opponents of these corporate written trade deals that have been selling America out. He's been talking about this for years before it was ever, you know, cool to talk about, before it was ever, you know, people had any consciousness of it as a political issue. He's written a book about it called The Myths of Free Trade. So I think that Hackett basically, one, couldn't portray Brown as sort of an insider, because, you know, let's be honest, challenging corporate written trade deals is not exactly something that makes either party very comfortable. Secondly, the idea that that it was a conservative progressive dichotomy. The fact is, if that was going to play out in any way, it would have played out in Sherrod Brown's favor. Paul Hackett had taken about five different positions on the Iraq War. You know, I mean, just as one example, he had sent out an email through the Democracy for America saying, you know, tell politicians to support a timetable for withdrawal in Iraq. And then 2 days later, he gave an interview with the press and said, anybody who calls for a timetable for withdrawal in Iraq, any politician who does that, is just plain wrong. So You know, Sherrod Brown, on the other hand, is a guy who voted against the war, has co-sponsored all sorts of legislation to demand the president bring the troops home. So again, I think that the second dichotomy that Hackett could have used to gain himself traction just wasn't there. And so now, you know, I think what happened, which is too bad, he basically looked at his fundraising. He looked at he couldn't get traction on the issues. He probably looked at the fact that Sherrod Brown has got a massive grassroots operation in Ohio, and he said, I'm going to lose. But what I'm most disappointed with is not even necessarily that he got out, although I think the voters should have decided that, but the fact that he got out and is sort of blaming people for, you know, the failure of his own campaign. I mean, here's the thing. Any candidate who says, I got forced out of a race, that's a euphemism for, I was going to lose. Because in this country, you know, one of the freedoms we still do have is that you know, political elections aren't done at the end of a bayonet. Nobody gets forced out of a race.
I could register to run as a Democrat or a Republican in any race here in Oregon, and if I can get enough signatures to get myself on the ballot, whether the party wants me or not, I can be in that race.
But that's true at Ohio as well. That's exactly right. And what I basically wrote yesterday was, look, here's the deal. Politics, the very definition of politics, is the effort of one candidate to, quote-unquote, force out another candidate, whether through the ballot box or other political pressure. So a politician saying, or a potential politician saying that they feel they don't like political pressure, because that's what Hackett's basically saying, is sort of like a baseball player saying or being upset with the fact that he's asked to play baseball.
This is kind of rough stuff, David. I mean, on the other hand, we've got, for example, Robert Perry blogging Democratic leaders betray Hackett, and he talks about, you know, the ultimate goal in politics should be to do what's right and smart and honorable, and he talks about how the Republicans have taken power by doing what's politically right, but maybe what's wrong for democracy. And he suggests, and I think a lot of people have been suggesting this, that there was some backroom deal cut that Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer got together and said, well, you know, Sherrod Brown has a better chance of winning than Paul Hackett does, so we're going to throw our support behind him, and that there's something wrong with that.
But what is that? First of all, what does that really mean? I mean, the idea that Harry Reid or Chuck Schumer can control an entire Senate race in Ohio is just ridiculous. Two, here's the more important point. Look, I've worked for candidates who the party establishment has, quote unquote, tried to force out. I don't even want to give credence to it, but I'll just give a hypothetical. I mean, I have worked for candidates who that has happened, and the successful candidates are the ones who couldn't be forced out because they had built their own political strength. Okay, and so basically, in put it another way, every politician, every person who is elected to office that you see in America, is in their own way a walking example of somebody who refused to be forced out, who couldn't be forced out. And candidates who are, quote-unquote, forced out, it's a referendum on their strength, whether at the grassroots level, whether at fundraising, whether at developing a message that builds all of those things. That's politics. Now, you know, I was one who would have preferred this to go to a primary. I would have preferred, you know, I would have preferred that Hackett and Brown not have the primary, but now that there was a primary, I would have preferred that this got, you know, chosen by the voters. And I don't quite understand why Hackett didn't decide to do that, other than he saw the polling, he saw the fundraising, he saw that his campaign didn't have.
Well, I think essentially what he's saying is that he wasn't going to get money from the traditional Democratic donors. They were going to give money to Brown,
To me, what that says is, here's a guy who ran in a special election, who was able to raise a huge amount of money off the internet because it was the only election happening at the time. And basically, he was suddenly faced in a new situation where he would have to do a lot of the unglamorous, not fun, down and dirty work that it takes to actually, unfortunately, in our system, which I don't endorse, but unfortunately, candidates have to do that kind of work.
But here's the reality, David. Hackett went out there and attacked Bush loudly and openly as an Iraq vet, and got a lot of publicity for that. You know, he got on Bill Maher's show and all that kind of stuff. I mean, he was nationally famous,
mm-hmm.
and thus without people really even knowing his position. I mean, at that time, his position on Iraq was that we should stay in Iraq.
That's right.
Although he wasn't saying that, you know, I mean, he said that to anybody who asked, but he wasn't saying that in his speeches. But he was still attacking Bush. But he became a hero for a lot of progressives because he was perceived as being blunt and outspoken. And don't we need blunt and outspoken politicians?
Yes, we do. But two things on that. One, Sherrod Brown is equally as blunt and outspoken. He might not be as famous, but he is equally blunt and outspoken. I would say that the more important thing, however, is that I think as a progressive movement, we need to not focus on cults of personality, and we need to not focus just on style, a.k.a. bluntness and speaking style and charisma. We need to focus as a movement on where these people are on the issues. I've written this before. The fact is, the Republican Party right now has a message and a party where everybody from the dog catcher to the President of the United States can run on that agenda. Our side right now, in part because of corporate forces, in part because of the Democratic Leadership Council, we can go all into that, but does not have a coherent progressive agenda. And so the reason I was supporting Sherrod Brown was because here's a guy who's been in Washington taking the tough votes, taking votes that neither party would take, pushing issues that neither party would push, and he did it in a situation which basically Washington is a pressure situation. So we know that somebody like Sherrod Brown, when they get to the Senate, is going to be what he has been. We've seen the record. With Hackett, he had no record, but even beyond that, he had made flip-flopping statements all over the place.
Yeah, stick around with us if you can. Can you stick around with us for just a second, David?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's take a break. We're talking with David Sirota, working for Change.com, SirotaBlog.com also, isn't it? I believe so. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. We have David Sirota with us. David Sirota is formerly a fellow with the Center for American Progress. You've worked on a number of political campaigns, David.
I have, yes.
And the author of Hostile Takeover. Produces an online magazine working for Change.com. And your blog is... David Sirota?
DavidSirota.com.
DavidSirota.com. Yeah,
yep.
Okay, great. And David, in the chat room, you're taking quite a beating here.
Shocker.
Well, you know, and people saying we need veterans, number one. Number two, you haven't addressed the fact that according to Paul Hackett, the Democrats were going to deny him funds, and they were contacting his fundraisers. Well, actually, this is according to a talk show host who says that this is what Hackett said. It's not, as far as I could tell, not what Hackett actually said when he had an opportunity to come out and say it, that Democrats in the party, specifically Chuck Schumer, were going to say, you know, we're not going to give you any money.
Again, what I would say to that is a ridiculously pathetic thing to complain about. That is politics. That is what every candidate who first runs for office faces, and I think that people who are
maybe David, it's that a lot of us have this kind of idealistic notion of politics, and we're just offended by the idea that that's what politics is.
Look, I'm the first person who thinks we need public financing of elections. Okay, I mean I'm the first person who would go out there and advocate for it. I've written about it, et cetera, et cetera. But we also have to look at the system that we have. Candidates have to raise money right now to run for office, okay? Somebody complaining that they're not able to raise as much money for a certain race, I mean, I'm sympathetic to that in some ways, but I'm also, having worked on political campaigns, I know one of the most important things that candidates can do is choose which race to run in. And one of the things that I've always thought is important for candidates is you have to pick a race you know you can win or be very competitive in. This was a race that Hackett, everything was aligned against him,
And the more important, the structural stuff was aligned against him. But here's the more important point, is that he couldn't make inroads and overcome those structural obstacles, which others can overcome, because he wasn't the progressive in the race, because he didn't have a progressive record, because he hadn't been working on behalf of the progressive agenda for years and years and years.
But he is a vet. I mean, you know that, you know, he's a vet who stood up and spoke out and took on George Bush. That seems to have that does have a lot of juice to it.
I mean, I think it does have a lot of juice to it, but I think that, but obviously, you know, it's not the only thing out there. I mean, I think people, basically, the people who support Sherrod Brown, the person who you mentioned wrote to you about Sherrod Brown, these are people, Sherrod Brown has been working on behalf of the progressive agenda in Ohio for years.
Yeah, I got to say, the email I got on this yesterday was split about 50-50.
Right.
And most of the email that I got from Ohio was in defense of Sherrod Brown, oddly.
I mean, look, the guy has been working on behalf of working people in that state for years. Now, does that take away from Hackett's military service? No. But why do people, I mean, they're both assets. Sherrod Brown has been a progressive champion for years. Paul Hackett's been a veteran who went to Iraq. You know, they're both assets. I don't think either one is necessarily bigger than the other. And I think that basically what happened was, you know, we can come up with all different kinds of things about what happened, but basically it came down to Sherrod Brown was going to crush Paul Hackett in the primary, and Paul Hackett didn't like that and basically decided to get out and save face. I mean, that what's kind of pathetic to me about this is that people are upset about that. I mean, that is politics. That is the definition of politics. And as I said in the last segment, every candidate, every elected official you see out there, the ones you like, the ones you hate, they are all walking examples of people who were able to overcome those structural obstacles. Because remember, in any race, any contested race, there's two candidates, three candidates, five candidates who are all competing to jostle against each other and get each other out and win. Okay, so complaining about what happened to Hackett is basically complaining that he lost, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, let's take a couple of quick calls here. Scott in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you're live with David Sirota. Scott?
Hello. Hey, well, one of these things I wanted to bring up is I heard yesterday that, you know, one of the reasons why there's a big to-do about this was that Sherrod Brown in August of last year decided not to run, so we found Hackett to run. So, you know, he's starting to get the machine going, changes his mind, and now Hackett's on the outside. You know, I don't know. I'm doing some Googling on it. There seems to be some... You know,
over at the Northwest Progressive, they're saying it's the other way around, that Brown had declared his candidacy and then Hackett decided to get into the race. I don't know which is true.
Well, I mean, I think it was a big muddle, actually.
Do you know, David?
Yeah, what happened was basically in the summer, Sherrod basically said that he wasn't ready to make a decision to run and that he wasn't going to run. And Hackett then indicated that he was leaning towards running. And Sherrod... While Hackett was sort of leaning towards running but hadn't declared what he was going to do, Sherrod said, you know, I was wrong back in the summer. I had some family issues that needed to be taken care of, and I've decided to that I'm going to get in this race.
Yeah, and at that point, that was it.
Yeah.
Interesting. David Sirota, workingforchange.com. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. The place where being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm sure the Republicans have such a mechanism. In fact, they probably just inject the candidate with some sort of... nano computer that automatically programs them to the talking points. But what I was wondering is if the Democratic Party has a mechanism for kind of guiding and maybe managing a little bit these candidates like Hackett that, you know, have some talent, show some local resonance with the citizenry before they, you know, saw off the limb they're sitting on.
Yeah, I frankly don't know if the Democratic Party on the inside, I would be amazed if they didn't, you know, have some sort of, you know, mentoring system or something. You know, let me sit down with you, son, and tell you these are the things you never say on the campaign trail, or these are the, this, you know, that kind of thing. The one power that they have, that the party has, is the ability to give money or withhold money to candidates. But the party does not have the power to keep people out of the party. I mean, for example, here in Oregon, we've got Ted Kulongoski, who's the governor, who's, you know, a pretty decent governor, but he's not a progressive. I'd say he's fairly progressive, but he's not full bore progressive, let's say. And he's got Pete Sorensen, who's a commissioner down in Lane County, who's following him around the state, making life miserable for him by you know, being really there, you know. And I'm sure the Democratic Party would love Pete Sorensen to, you know, go away, shut up, and be quiet, but he's not going to. And, you know, that was the point that I made in the chat room just a minute ago was, you know, people in political campaigns who put up with what's going on and stick it out and fight through are called candidates or congressmen, you know, and people who don't are called people on the outside looking in. And my model in this is Howard Dean. The Democratic Party did not want Howard Dean running for president. The Democratic Party tried to keep Howard Dean out. Howard Dean was fought all the way, and Howard Dean kept saying, I'm going to stay with it. I'm going to keep on coming back. I'm like the Energizer Bunny. You can beat me down, and I'm going to come back. And Howard Dean today is the chairman of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
He didn't say, I'm really offended. Somebody called up my donors and said, don't give money to me, give it to the other guy, because we like the other guy, and therefore I'm going to leave the game, and I'm never going to come back. I mean, he didn't do that. He said, you know, I'm going to stick with this thing. I'm going to fight. I believe in my country enough, and I believe in the political process enough to be part of it, and I respect that. I think that, you know, Paul Hackett is a very charismatic guy, I wish he had taken on Gene, you know, Mean Gene there in the House, and it would, you know, and I think that he could have beat her this time around, and she's running for re-election right now.
Yeah,
and
we just don't have a surplus of talent out there.
We don't.
It seems to me.
Yeah, and we can't be throwing people over the side. But I, you know, on the other hand, for people to say, you know, I'm jumping over the side, and then afterwards say I got thrown over the side. I don't know. I'm sorry. What can I say?
Yeah,
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call.
I agree with you. Thanks.
Yeah, good talking to you. Michelle in Long Beach. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. Well, I called in the sense of when you were talking with David Schroeder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the financial aspect, and, you know, I couldn't help but reflect on there is a young, a man down here running for a seat in the Senate. His name was Steve Young. He was running for, I can't remember, it was president had given a position to one of the representatives down here, so he's running for the seat. And I'll never forget the leader of the Democratic district, congressional district that I was in. I asked him about how it was going with this runner, Steve Young, and he says, well, we're having trouble with him financially. He needs to put up $10,000, and we'll put up $10,000, and so on and so forth. And you know, it was the one bastion that, you know, it was very Republican area, but this guy had great hopes, yet they just wouldn't back him because of this financial aspect. And I know what David was saying, that is part of, but yet...
Well, at a certain level, that's part of the Darwinian nature of politics. I mean, if you can get out there and knock on enough doors and raise enough money, and Howard Dean was able to do that with the Internet in the face of all this opposition, if you can raise the money to do it, you can do it. Marion Degato in the chat room just says, you know, well, why isn't Paul Hackett running for the 2nd Congressional District there in Ohio for Gene what's-her-name's seat? And he could. He could. He could tomorrow morning. There's nothing to stop him from doing that. He's chosen not to.
And
I frankly think that if he were to go out on the web and say, hey, I'm running against Gene, and I'll take on all comers in the primary, and then I'm going to take her on in the main election, and he'd raise money from all over the country.
Well, yes, exactly. And I think he could even do it with what he said, you know, in his withdrawal from this race.
Yes, I mean, people, this is my original point was that by saying, you know, I will not run for that, and, you know, what I said is what I said, and, you know, my word is my bond and all that. Well, you know, number one, in politics, you don't say never. You say, you know, I'm not going to do it right now. I mean, you just kind of understand the game you're playing. And that was David's point about baseball. Understand the game you're playing. And number two, there is no shortage of politicians, good people in office who have said, you know, I'm not going to do this. And then they said later, I've changed my mind. And I think that, you know, the American people will say, that's fine, you know, if you've changed your mind. In fact, a lot of times we want them to change their minds. In fact, we actively campaign for them to change their minds. We beg them to change their minds. We call 800 numbers to get them to change their minds.
Right. Well, you know, I think we've all been there, too, where, you know, our idealist thought process gets slammed down.
Yeah.
And maybe he can just realize that maybe he was thinking more on an idealist, which we'd all like. We'd all like utopia. But maybe he could reflect on that and approach it from that manner. You know,
well, let's hope so. Let's hope that Paul Hackett gets back into the political race.
I agree with you.
You know, I agree with Howard Dean's op-ed piece this morning where he said, you know, these are the kind of people we need. He wasn't taking a position, you know, pro or con on it, but he just said, you know, this is the kind of guy we need in politics, and I agree with him. And, you know, it's – anyhow, Michelle, thanks a lot for the call. Good talking to you. 1-866-440-8466, our number, Kodak in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Kodak.
Yes, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great. Haven't heard from you in a while. How's life?
Oh, it's just great, Tom. I have a new son I'm enjoying, so I couldn't be happier.
Oh, that's wonderful. Congratulations.
Also, I haven't called the show because, as usual, you know, I like to at least be able to add to the subject matter or be uplifting. And this happened when I was listening to a program on my local NPR affiliate. The radio program was called the American Radio Works, and they were giving clips from great speakers and people who have influenced the American way of life. And Barbara Jordan was her name, and she was elected from the elected representative there from Texas. And she was part of the Nixon impeachment hearings, and she was so passionate about her belief and the power of the Constitution that she wasn't going to idly sit by and let this president and its members subvert or do anything to damage the Constitution. And mm-hmm. It was a very, very powerful and very poignant point that she made that is very applicable to today, as to give those people who are the inquisitors, as she said, and a backbone or spine or a path on which they can follow to seek out the truth.
Yeah. Impeachment is something that's on the mind of a lot of people right now. And this is one of the amazing things about Dick Cheney and this shooting incident. You know, whether it was alcohol or whether it was an affair or whether it was just a plain old accident and he just doesn't like talking to the police or whatever it was, it has succeeded in pushing off the front page and out of the discussion. And I'm going to keep bringing it back to this.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that last week the guy who was the head of the CIA operations during the entire, you know, from 2000 to 2005 for the Near East, for Afghanistan, Iraq, that whole area, said, hey, we, the CIA, did not tell Cheney any of this stuff that he's been telling all you guys about there being a connection between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. And the number one. And then number two, Scooter Libby coming out and saying, oh, well, when I released classified information, it was because Cheney told me to, or it was because my boss told me to. Well, who's his boss? Cheney. And it was either Cheney or Bush, you know, or both. Actually, he said my bosses, my superiors. It was plural. So Cheney and Bush were the only two people who were superior to him in the food chain. And these are impeachable offenses, both of them.
Also, yeah. Tom, in her conclusion, she asked the question, has the president committed offenses planned and directed or acquiesced in the course of conduct which the Constitution will not tolerate? She said that is the question, and we know that. And we already have that today because it is clearly stated that the president does not have the power to eavesdrop on American citizens without a warrant.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And in closing, we also need a song that takes the movement forward. A guy by the name of Michael Franti, the band is Spearhead, has a CD out. That's called Everyone Deserves Music, and he has a song on there that says that you can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one, Kodak. Thanks a lot for that closing thought. a good one. Dan, I don't have a city for you here. I'm not sure where you're calling from. Dan, we just have a few seconds. Oh, in Seattle. Hey, Dan, what's up? We just have a few seconds here.
Well, I was just calling to mention, I'd heard about internment camps Cheney's company had...
Halliburton just got a $300 million contract to build them around the United States.
Right, and it was really concerned me, and I thought that that might be something we might try to get people realized.
We're trying to get more information on this. I've talked about it on this program a couple of times. We don't have any specifics yet as to where these things are going to be or exactly why, and there's a lot of people very, very concerned about them. I'm among them. Dan, I'll give you more information as I find it out.
Thanks
for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
Yeah, I think it really is
from
coming.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Tell me what... combines these two stories. Number one from the New York Post, Dubai Ports World has won control for $6.8 billion of six U.S. ports, including, in addition to New York, New Jersey, Miami, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. This is owned by the United Arab Emirates, whose banking system, considered the commercial center of the Arab world, provided most of the cash for the 9/11 hijackers. The country whose banking system provided the cash for the 9/11 hijackers is now in the process of taking possession of six of our ports. Indeed, much of the operational planning for the World Trade Center attacks took place inside the United Arab Emirates, which now is taking control of six of our ports. Now, what does that have to do with this story? Your debt, your share of the national debt, $27,525.47. If you're a family of two, the breadwinner's share, $55,000. Family of three, $82,500. Family of four, if you're the breadwinner, your debt of the your share of the national debt, $110,101.91. That's as of 5 a.m. this morning, Pacific time. We are paying interest to the tune right now. This is a family of four. Is paying interest on the national debt this year of $2,551 so far. That's as of February. Last year, you paid $4,314 in interest. The year before that, $4,200 in interest. This on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up and George Herbert Walker Bush ran up, and now George W. Bush is running up, the interest that we're paying. Well, what do these stories have to do with each other? We are spending ourselves into this giant hole, running up this giant debt. We're borrowing money from overseas. These people loan us the money. We pay them interest. They've got all this profit from this interest that you and I are paying them. And what do they do with that profit? They got to do something. They're buying our ports. It's incredible. Incredible. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, what's this Hackett and Brown thing?
Yeah.
You know, I think this is just basically the party leaders just being scared, being little fraidy cats, you know.
How so?
What's that?
How so?
Well, I think that they've been beat, and they want to try to emulate the
but
Republicans
the party leaders did not
to be slick, you know. They're
but Paul Hackett could have stayed in the race.
Yes, he could have.
So it wasn't the party leaders who
if they actually went and told people not to give money to people, that was not right. That was absolutely not right.
If I'm a Democratic Party donor. And I'm not, but if I were, and somebody came to me, and let's say I've been giving my money to Congresswoman Darlene Hooley, who represents me, who's a Democrat, and somebody came to me and said, you know, we're going to run somebody against Darlene Hooley, and we think that person can beat her, and they're more progressive than she is. Give money to them instead of to her. Is that telling me to give money to that person, or is that telling me not to give money to Darlene Hooley?
well, you should give your money to whoever you want, the way I feel about it, and if they can talk you into that, fine. But I think they should let them fight it out. By the sounds of it, these are two pretty good candidates.
Right, and that's why you I'm know, saying, why did one of these guys simply walk away from
let him? Let him,
they did.
Let him go get the money that he wants, go let her go get the money and let them fight it out. Why do they need to get involved? Why do they need to be slick? Because they're scared.
I don't believe that anybody was involved with force here.
Okay, now that's what the rumor is, that they actually got on the phone and started calling people and telling people not to do this.
But
that's what people are saying. So.
But when Paul Hackett was given an opportunity to say that yesterday on the radio, he didn't say it.
Okay, because that's what I've been hearing.
Yeah, and I know, and that's also my point of, if somebody says to me that I should, that as a donor, and I'm a good member of the party, and I'm saying to the party, hey, I want to support you. Which candidate do you think has the best chance of winning? Which candidate should I be giving my money to? And the party says, give your money to candidate A. Does that mean that the party's telling me not to give my money to candidate B?
No, I don't
But candidate, candidate
you,
B
you,
might
you
think so, and then if candidate B
way,
goes out and starts yelling, oh, they're saying not to give money to me, but to give it to the other guy, hey, that's politics.
Yeah, right, and you don't have to, you know, just, you know.
And then if candidate B decides to drop out of the race.
But this just shows me that we got, you know, we have some problems in the Democratic Party. And it's
I don't disagree with you at all, Mike. I absolutely agree with you.
But there's a way to solve, you know, we can take this at the precinct level. You know, that's where we can make these changes. It's not at the top. It's not at the leadership of the party. It's at the precinct level. It's at the grassroots level. That's how things get changed in this country.
I agree. That's
and
why I think that Paul Hackett should have stayed in the
party. We need to change it at the precinct level.
That's why I think Hackett should have stayed in the race. He should have been out there knocking on doors and raising money and doing the hard work. He was unwilling to do that.
I'll agree with
you. He decided that he wasn't willing to do that.
He should have stayed in the race. He should have. Absolutely. I'll agree with you there.
Okay. I just don't know how to say it more specific. Anyhow, we got to move along. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Scott in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Tom.
We got 1 minute. What's up?
Yeah, the FISA power related to an agent of a foreign power also relates to businesses. So I just wanted to throw in addition to your concerns, that if a foreign corporation owns ports, then Bush doesn't need to have to do extraordinary issues to do surveillance. He can go under FISA authority in all ports.
So maybe that's why he's selling our ports to the UAE?
Yeah, because it's actually...
Because then he can spy on them?
Foreign ownership by businesses means that they qualify to be under FISA.
But, you know, I don't get the upside of that.
Well, I actually think Bush would like the idea that he doesn't have to break the law to be able to spy on the ports to do things.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Except that he's already breaking the law anyway.
Right, exactly.
And the plot thickens, Scott. Interesting
thought.
Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Coming up on tomorrow's Tom Hartman program, conservative Hans Bader says, we the people should not be overlooking corporate bookkeeping. Yeah. Swami Vyadananda, the Cosmic Comic, is dropping by. Also, is Homeland Security preparing for martial law and detention center camps right here in the United States? All that and more on tomorrow's Tom Hartman radio program. Remember, friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.